Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everybody. We're going to get going. I'm Adam Hochschild, and I'm here with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and it's a great pleasure to be with her and to see all of you here. A reminder, if you haven't already silenced your cell phone or pager, please take a moment to do so now. And any of us who don't carry cell phones should feel morally superior. Also, another reminder, after we're finished here, an hour and a quarter from now, Roxanne will be signing books right in the atrium just outside the door here. A rare chance at this book festival to get your book, to buy a book and get it signed without having to walk several blocks to a signing area. So it's a great pleasure for me to be talking with Roxanne because I reviewed her book several months ago and it just stood out for me tremendously from a stack of other books on the subject of guns and gun control, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But first, let me introduce her. She grew up in rural Oklahoma, and your mother was part Native American, am I right about that? And your grandfather was a Wobbly, right? I only became aware recently because of some research I'm doing that a little over 100 years ago, Oklahoma was a socialist stronghold. And there were, I believe, six members of the party in the state legislature. How we got from there to Scott Pruitt, maybe you can tell us later on. Roxanne has written a number of books, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Red Dirt, Growing Up Hokie, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, and Blood on the Border, A Memoir of the Contra War. She lives in San Francisco. Let's start by telling us a little bit about when you were growing up. Were guns a big part of the culture there?
Yes, it was.
It's on.
It was certainly gun culture, undoubtedly. I'll just tell you, because I'm so proud of it, my grandfather named my father Moyer Haywood Scarberry Pettibone Dunbar.
Hold it a little closer to your mouth.
My grandfather named my father Moyer Haywood Scarberry Pettibone Dunbar. Those are the founders of IWW. Born in 1907. So when I grew up, I came of age in the 50s, 40s, 50s, a horrible time. And my dad was a tenant farmer. His father had actually been a veterinarian, the Wobbly, a veterinarian, and had a farm, owned land. And he was a large animal veterinarian. So actually, it gives a different picture of the IWW if you know how varied these labor activists were. He was also in the Socialist Party, which many of them were. They did different things. So I did not grow up with being proud. I did grow up with being proud of that. But when the 50s came, my dad started telling me not to tell anyone those stories about his father. So the Cold War, had a chilling effect. I won't go into how, it happened before that. It happened with a Great Repression during World War I, Woodrow Wilson, of destroying the Socialist Party and the all labor activity in Oklahoma. But growing up in Canadian County, Oklahoma, which is a kind of west central plains, just the beginning of the plains, middle Oklahoma to the west, wheat agribusiness area when I grew up. It was my father and my two brothers, of course, we had guns in the house. But my mother, which I appreciate very much for this, she hated guns. She was terrified of guns. She never said why. I don't know what happened to her in her very difficult childhood. But maybe she was just smart. I don't know. But she would not let me and my sister touch the guns. And there were lots and lots of fights about the guns being in the house. And it seemed like they cleaned them all the time, you know, this ritual of cleaning and oiling and taking apart and putting back. And they just had a shotgun and a .22. You know, it wasn't like they had AR-15s or something then, or Tommy guns. But I saw this kind of glint in the eye, you know, that stayed with me about what I call, you know, gun addiction or gun love in the first chapter of this book. So I really was immunized to guns, to the gun culture, but that didn't mean I didn't later get into it myself as a radical in the 1960s and experience that gun addiction for a little bit.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I talk about that. It's a first chapter. It's not a memoir, but I felt like I had to come clean as well about the story. And where I, you know, I couldn't just say I grew up in gun culture, therefore this is my credibility. You know, I had to first of all say I hated guns. I grew up in gun culture and I hated guns. I mean, even people took their guns to the church. I was Baptist, you know, they took their guns to church. It's not as if the preacher preached against guns or something. It was just everyone had guns. So in the 60s, as some of you who may have been there, I can see with me, there was a, especially the influence of the Black Panthers here in Oakland. I was in the South. I was in Los Angeles, but then I came up to the Bay Area for 67, 68, right when the, you know, really to support the Panthers. And their focus on getting the gun, and also this, all the national liberation movements around the world that many of us admired so much, and Uruguay and Argentina and of course, in Africa, the national liberation movements, and Vietnam. So I think we got into a radical gun culture, which I don't, well, you know, it's complicated. I don't regret that so much as I think we found out that the Second Amendment does not apply to those of us who are really opposing the government, because we get criminalized. The Panthers got criminalized. Robert Williams got criminalized. We got criminalized who did that. So we really started setting up this, we had this women's study group. I was in New Orleans at the time, which was total gun culture. They didn't have any gun laws whatsoever, any regulations whatsoever on guns. Except the few federal ones, the Tommy gun is banned, or stolen guns across state lines and so forth. So we actually armed ourselves in self-defense, because we started several of us went to Cuba on the Vince Ramos Brigade in 1970, and we came back and there were Cuban exiles who were formed into these groups called Omega and Alpha and other things that were terrorists. And they mainly attacked other Cubans who, you know, were slightly friendly with Fidel Castro, with the revolution. And we know there were, you know, in 1962, they were CIA connected, the Bay of Pigs and all that. Well, they continued on. And they were, after we came back and we were interviewed by the Picayune, the New Orleans Picayune Press, they started threatening us and leaving nasty notes and phone calls, everyone's name in the phone book in those days. And we really got scared. And then the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke, who had just made himself a wizard or something, and he started calling us, first of all, trying to recruit us, because he hated the government too, and then threatening us because he figured out who we really were. And we lived in this flimsy, falling apart wooden house in the Irish Channel. If you know New Orleans, it's not even now very gentrified. It's a very poor area, swampy, got completely flooded, of course, during the last flood. So it was not well policed. It wasn't much security there. And we had flimsy locks. It would be easy, you know, to break in. So we decided to get guns. So we started going to gun shows across the river, across the lake, and got fascinated, started getting fascinated with guns. We really just needed a shotgun if we needed anything with birdshot, but that's not very sexy, you know, what you see all these other guns. I tell people, don't look closely at a gun. You know, it's an erotic object. It really is empowering. You know, you hear women say, oh, I feel so empowered with a gun. This is the new pink gun culture. And of course you do, because you can kill someone. But is that a good thing, a good way to feel empowered? So it was, you know, they're dangerous. They're dangerous, and in more ways than one. So that was the experience I had, and it went on for about 2 years.
Let me read a few sentences from the book and ask you to use that as a taking off point for commenting about gun culture and what it means. 74% of gun owners in the United States are male, and 82% of gun owners are white, which means that 61% of all adults who own guns are white men. But this group accounts only for 31% of the total U.S. population. The top reason U.S. Americans give for owning a gun is for protection. What are the majority of white men so afraid of? So this takes us to the question of what is gun culture and why has it come to stand for something that goes beyond any rational need for protection? Or we can also argue whether you are protecting yourself by having a house full of guns that, you know, your children can stumble into and accidentally set off and so on. But so what's the meaning of gun culture?
Well, there's another statistic I'll point out. There are 300 million guns, firearms in the hands of civilians in the United States, and that's the population of the United States. But only 30% of the population own even one gun, no guns at all. Probably most of you here. Maybe I think more than 30%.
Yeah. Hold the mic right up to you.
I think probably many more than 30%, many more than 70% of people here probably do not own guns, but the national average is 30% the population owns guns. And so that means each owner of a firearm owns 8. So then you have the question of when does self-defense, what is it that you would need 8? Or maybe 20 or 30, because that's the average. You know, and most people own more, you know, they own a lot. So that's one question, and these, of course, are majority white men. So I think what we have to understand is that the Second Amendment represents a white republic, the rights of white supremacy, that it's fundamentally based in that. These militias in the Second Amendment, first of all, it is an individual right. I agree with Heller. It's an individual right. But the Heller decision, the decision of Scalia, you know, in 2008, is an individual right or not. Never before had there been any judicial action on that question. This case was brought for that particular purpose to establish that, and they were pretty sure they'd get it, and they did, as an individual right. But it also said that that doesn't mean there can't be regulation of guns. There can be, but it is an individual right. So you balance then, you know, like free speech or anything else in those in the Bill of Rights. But it's important to know that the National Guard that exists now, California National Guard, all the National Guard, is already provided for in the Constitution under the moniker state militias. It's Article 8 of the Constitution. So the Democratic Party argument or talking points that this means National Guard, the militias in the is absurd. Because why would you need it in the Bill of Rights when you already have the Constitution establishing the National Guard and the U.S. Army? So it is an individual right. It's very clear. That's what the Bill of Rights is. It's individual rights. So we have to deal with that. What were they for? And why? Oh, okay. That hurts. That means I'm talking too much because my wrists hurt. Already existing in the colonial, in the colonies as they got developed, right off, you found it in, you know, documentation of it by 1632 in New England, 1642 in Virginia, of actually the requirement for every individual white man to be armed, even in church, even at work, anywhere outside the house.
And this was a requirement. It was not just a right.
It was a requirement at first.
This was in Massachusetts and Connecticut.
And Virginia, when they were the first ones established. So then other colonies started coming in. Who were they fighting? They weren't fighting the French. They weren't fighting their colonial governments. They were taking land from the Indians by force. Savage war, they called it at that time. And so these settlers were on the front lines of doing that because they had a motive. They wanted the land. And they wanted the land for plantation, agribusiness, not some farm, family farm, you know, to feed themselves, for agribusiness, raising non-food crops, unless you consider the tons of rice they raised to ship to the Caribbean to feed their enslaved Africans. That was even a commercial product. So cotton, indigo, tobacco, all of them commodities. So this land was taken, and then by 1670 or so, the racial regime of slavery, which is unique in the Western Hemisphere, where slavery existed all over, this slave codes that were developed, they carved out of these militias, these citizens' militias, self-formed, self-regulated, slave patrols. And those slave patrols then, as they ethnically cleansed east of the Mississippi and forcibly removed the native people to where I grew up, Oklahoma, Indian Territory, the slave patrols became, you know, the dominant use. But the militias still were used west of the Mississippi before and after the Civil War for the, you know, using the same regime of settler self-organization militias like Kit Carson, you know, to kill Indians and take their lands. So that's the racial white supremacist basis of the Second Amendment. That's why it wasn't discussed even when they put it in. They didn't have arguments about it. They just transported it from the Virginia Constitution that already existed. Madison and Jefferson, they brought the whole Bill of Rights basically from that and put it in the federal. And then there's no legislation There was one court decision in the 1870s, and then there was a court decision in the actually a congressional act in the 1930s to outlaw the Thompson machine gun because of the gangs in Chicago during Prohibition. And the National Rifle Association testified and said that it was not in any way an abuse of the Second Amendment. That's the only time the Second Amendment was ever even mentioned in legislation or in a court case until, another Supreme Court decision, the Board of Education, Brown versus the Board of Education, desegregation, 1953. After this, immediately these white citizens councils, John Birch Society, and their slogan was impeach Earl Warren. Those signs were all over my little rural county. Impeach Earl Warren. Who is this guy anyway? You know, he must be really a horrible person. Well, he was a Supreme Court justice, you know,
Chief Justice.
Chief Justice. In the decision, the board for, he was also the governor of California when they incarcerated the the Japanese Americans too, but he wasn't a great guy himself. But the writing was on the wall that, you know, with national liberation movements, the decolonization, the United States is going to have to do something.
Well, what I found very original in your book was this. If you followed the debate over the Second Amendment over the years, it's a very sterile one because it all has to do with whether the reference in the Second Amendment to a well-regulated militia, whether the right to bear arms refers to a well-regulated militia or to individuals, as the NRA would have you believe and as this last decision of the Supreme Court more or less decides. But I love the way you said, no, it really does refer to militias, but what were those militias? They were not, you know, the, you know, brave folks who defeated the redcoats at Lexington and Concord. They're not the National Guard. As you say, that's already provided for elsewhere in the Constitution. These are the forces that seized the land from Native Americans and that recaptured escaped slaves. So that's the heritage there. But it seems to me that that strand of the heritage of the gun rights movement comes together with another strand in recent years coming from all the colonial wars or imperial wars that the United States is engaged in, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I think there's... thank you. I was going to make one other point about the NRA before we go on, because that's a big boogeyman, that the NRA actually got taken over by an organization, a white supremacist organization from Washington State called the Second Amendment Foundation. And they were the ones that really carved out that this is, you know, this is what we're going to use. This is what we're going to use to maintain or take back the white republic. So that was in 1977. That's when you see the thing go up, you know, the NRA as a militant white nationalist organization. Membership organization, a nonprofit. You can, you know, if you give money to the NRA, you actually get to take it off your taxes. And it's always been that way, but it's the only legitimate organization that is a is truly a white nationalist organization now. With a mass base, remember, with a mass base, not a lot of money, $300 million a year. So anyway, there's that, but then... At the same time as the civil rights movement was gaining and gaining and gaining and gaining sympathy all over the North, and I would say probably a great percentage of especially younger white people, were supporting, became anti-racist and acted upon that support. At the same time, the Vietnam War was, of course, it started in 1955 when they took over from the French, but it was all subversive, clandestine until, you know, the 1965. So that period, the Vietnam War building up, the loss of that war in 1975 was the other thing, because that meant the whole world was surrounding, not just, you know, blacks in the United States and Native Americans and Mexicans surrounding and, you know, diluting the pure white race. But in fact, the whole world was against us. So that was another shock after the Board of Education, the desegregation, the shock of losing the Vietnam War. But the other effect was, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of combat veterans. There were I can't even remember the number now. You have to read Viet Nguyen's "Nothing Ever Changes," his book on how many U.S. soldiers, combat soldiers, came back to the United States. The best way to find, who owns multiple guns, weapons, is that they have been combat vets. They've been combat vets. So now we have these wars continuing. We have thousands and thousands of thousands. And the other part of that is, part of the book is also the white nationalist infiltration of police forces and especially the Marines. Combat.
Yeah, I believe that a combat veteran returned to civilian life is more than twice as likely to be a gun owner as a non-vet. Tell us what you think about the new wave of growth of the militia movement in this country in the last few years, especially since Obama's election. And that number of armed militia groups has soared in the United States just in the last year or so. This is obviously another facet of this same problem. Where do you see that going?
Well, the first big surge was, of course, under the Reagan administration in the 80s. And these wars were not publicized, but there was an endless counterinsurgency in Central America, in the Philippines, in Angola, Mozambique, southern Africa. So there were, you know, all kinds of special forces that got formed for all of that. And a lot of it was not publicized as war, you know, but as allies, you know, or civil wars and stuff. So there were many of these. The militia movements really came out of the posse comitas, you know, that formed in the 80s. And a lot of these were fairly well-to-do agribusiness operators. They call themselves farmers in the Midwest and in the plains in South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa, Ohio, Michigan, there were foreclosures on these, you know, on these fairly wealthy, well-to-do, because the big corporate agribusiness corporations were taking over. If you didn't get branded with Borden's milk, you're independent, very good dairy.
You're talking about the 1950s or
1980s. And so this was the, you know, when the truckers, they drove their tractors to Washington, D.C. and all these, you know, it was the late 70s and early 80s. It was a part of a kind of move that did bring Reagan to power. But the Posse Comitatus is kind of the core of what then happened in the 90s. And there was a kind of chilling of that militia movement when Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. And he had joined, you know, after he got out of the Gulf War, he had gotten recruited, or he found because none of us were there, I guess. He found white nationalists, or they found him, and the one of their compounds was and is still in Oklahoma, Ellum City. And he went there, and he was introduced to the Turner Diaries and Christian identity and racism that he hadn't really, been in. He was up from upstate New York, deindustrialized upstate New York, working class guy. But he blew up the federal building. He was became a true believer because of Waco, because of the ATF behavior in Waco 2 years earlier. In 1993, so 1995, that sort of the militia sort of incubated. They didn't go away, but they were less prominent. But in the 90s, they were all over on television, and they were forming everywhere and strutting around with their guns and everything. They kind of got quiet, but yeah. Then under Obama, they came back again. They never were gone. That's what you get to know if you're from a, place like rural Oklahoma, because you know these people, and you know they didn't go away. And there they are again, and their kids are there this time.
But were they so heavily armed before? Because when I think back to, uniformed right-wing groups in this country, German-American Bund of the 1930s, the Italian, the black shirt admirers of Mussolini, they got dressed up in their Nazi regalia and their black shirt regalia, but they didn't carry guns around then. Now they do. And when we've had these occupations of federal land in Oregon and elsewhere, people are out there with their guns. What are these folks going to do if Trump leaves office? Whether we're so lucky as to have him forced out by impeachment, or whether he's simply not reelected in 2020. What are these folks going to do then?
Well, I advise you not to read the commentary sections of the New York Times when anything is written about impeaching Trump. They're really scary. There are things like insurrection, armed uprising, just code words like that. This is what will happen. I was afraid it would happen. I was half afraid he wouldn't win, and he would, claim it was like the Democrats are complaining, that it was interference from something or other, or cheating. And he had all these people riled up, these white nationalists all riled up from his stadium speeches that were a little bit like Nuremberg speeches, and in those early days of the Nazis, and really pointing to, Mexicans, Muslims, really pointing out and beating up some, or radicals. And I was afraid then, and I actually am now. In fact, if he's not reelected, I'm afraid. Not even just impeach. If he's not reelected, I think the same thing will happen. Then I think if he is reelected, he'll try to extend his presidency. This is what I feel is the forces behind him, these Mercers and these Koch brothers and all. By the way, Fred Koch of the Koch brothers, the father of the two now, was a founder of the John Birch Society. So I do think we can't just say shake and be afraid, but I'm saying we should be prepared and develop some different strategies for understanding this and dealing with it, because it is very serious.
Now, the Koch brothers have been financial backers of the NRA, what do you think their motives are there?
Well, the NRA, the Koch brothers, like the Mercers are the ones that funded Steve Bannon and what's his thing? What was that?
Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah. that they want no government except the army. They want no government. They want no governments for social services, only corporate and, you know, and for to disassemble anything that is for social services. You may have read in this morning's San Francisco Chronicle, they're actually reducing the rent supplements of people who've been homeless. And they're on the edge, just the line anyway. They'll be homeless again with the, you know, with the other homeless. And that took years and years to get that supplement through. And that's just a tiny thing, but that's what they're picking away with. And this Congress who, you know, they're just going on about their work of deregulating everything. Everything. Here in California, I'm very proud of our politicians for really standing up. Let's give them a hand, you know. Our municipal, except Orange County, our municipal and our state, I think Becerra and De Leon and these people, that way they wrote the, they fought the immigration thing. You know, they're really, and even Jerry Brown seems to have a little bit of spark. So it could change any moment, you know, because we do have the Great Central Valley out there. And the next, Speaker of the House is going to be that Nunez guy who is not Mexican. He's Portuguese, Azores descendant, very conservative people. He is not Mexican. People keep saying, oh, why do these Mexicans keep voting for Trump? Not every Nunez is a Mexican. Anyway, we do have something to fear here, but I think we have a great opportunity also here to really get active in ways that are very difficult in other parts of the country now.
Is there a possibility for getting active productively, successfully right now on the issue of guns? We were talking just before we began here about Parkland and how there is something different about the reaction to this latest mass shooting than there have been to the shootings, you know, in Las Vegas and elsewhere before it. Do you think there's a possibility for hope then? How do you see this unfolding?
Yeah, I was telling Adam before we came here that my book came out January 6th, and people said, well, God, it's too bad, because it was scheduled for the fall, and we put it up because I didn't finish it. And it would have come out, you know, right when the Las Vegas, the biggest mass shooting in history, and, you know, that kind of what they define as a mass shooting. 58 people killed, and this guy, they found, you know, he's a rich man, he had many, many houses, and every one of them an arsenal, and yet not one illegal weapon or ammunition, not one illegal thing, bought in four different states. I follow these things closely. So I said, well, don't worry, unfortunately, another one will come along. But it won't matter because it only lasts 2 days. You know, the uproar, maybe legislation. The Democrats even sat in on Congress after the Orlando shooting and saying, we shall overcome. And then nothing happens. So, and nothing happened on Obama and the Democratic. You know, a Democratic, full Democratic Congress, Obama, the first 4 years, nothing happened on gun control. So I think we thought with Sandy Hook, this had to change, that this was, and the Sandy Hook people have remained extremely active. I just think they can have much better understanding of the Second Amendment and not dismiss it. It's an organic, active thing. It is a thing. It is the main legalistic instrument that white nationalists, the white supremacists, have. So why is so this is in perfect sync with the you know, coke industries, which are, you know, is completely a fossil fuel. I was in Wichita and spoke last year, which was very interesting because everything is Coke, 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 everywhere you go. The auditorium I spoke in was the Coke Auditorium because that's where they're based.
But coming back to the Parkland shooting, this most recent thing, Is there a possibility for doing something now, for really getting any kind of meaningful gun control passed on the national level that there wasn't before?
Well, I think how I see it as this elder veteran of social movements all my life is, you know, the social movement itself that got ignited with the high school kids. And it was a very peculiar configuration, a very affluent school in a red state, but a very affluent suburb of Miami. Even the shooter was from a very well-to-do family. And a school that is well-funded with parent participation, with the best teachers, with the highest pay, and years overseas, you know, fully funded. They also have, though, one of the largest JROTC programs. And this was something that confounded me at the time. It's so little it's been made of the fact that the shooter, Nathaniel Cruz, started in JROTC at that school when he was 11 years old. Now, in JROTC, NRA supplies the weapons and the targets free as a grant to schools. They're in almost every high school.
So it's not a Pentagon program, junior ROTC?
It is. It is a Defense Department mandate. I mean, it's a congressional mandate from back in 1916, National Defense Act for these ROTC. But they get gifts. NRA gives the gifts, the target shoot, the targets, full body human looking targets, the weapons. They learn to shoot lethal automatic military weapons. And this kid was in his JROTC outfit, the maroon shirt with the JROTC and khaki pants, when he did the shooting. And yet there were two JROTC students shot. He randomly shot. I'm sure he didn't aim at them particularly. They had military funerals for them. So this disconnect is just blew my mind. It's still no one's mentioning it. And except World Beyond War, that wonderful website. But it's, you know, that connection of how he came to be gun addicted and how he came to, as I see it, he wanted to be a soldier and he didn't make it, so he decided to kill his schoolmates because he got kicked out of school for being, you know, so aggressive and violent. And so, you know, apparently there's nothing being reviewed about that program or other ROTC programs.
But come back to the question, though, of whether the fact that these students have become such wonderful activists, they put on that extraordinary rally in Washington, they got a small piece of legislation passed in Florida, do you see any chance of this spreading and making headway in the next year?
I guess I keep avoiding that question because I'm pretty pessimistic about that. If you look at this, at least at the federal level, and unfortunately the state level, we've also, it's really dire, you know, the majority of governorships, the majority of legislators, state legislation. I mean, by the Electoral College, this is how Trump won. And most legislation for guns, you know, constitutionally, is sort of a states' rights thing. It's funny, we're in California are now fighting for states' rights, and these.
Hey, we're defending the FBI. We never used to do that either.
I think the movement is so important because these are kids. And I remember how fast I learned from the civil rights movement when I was a kid, my last year of high school in Oklahoma City in 1955-56. It was the first year of integration in Oklahoma. And I went to the first integrated school. Of course, it was the poor people's school. You know, it was a trade school. And they brought African-American students, mainly athletes, you know, from the all-black school, which was actually a better school than ours because they had more community involvement and support. And I saw brutal race riots in that school, and it was white students, you know, beating up. And there was only one black woman. The others were black guys. And I just, you know, I was still a good Baptist, and I, a true believer, and I said, this is unfair. You know, I mean, it just like, this is not right. This is unjust. People outnumbered, they haven't done anything to you, you know, and it was daily. Of course, we all had to work full-time when we went to school, so there wasn't much of a school community. But I started writing for the school newspaper because they had a printing press. It was one of the trades you could major in. And I was supposed to be in secretarial, but I snuck over to journalism. And there they were kind of, you know, kind of a little hotbed of liberals in there, and the teacher was too, and there were gay people, and, you know, it was quite something. But they just let me write all these things, you know, criticizing these this behavior, racist behavior. And then there were sit-ins going on downtown. So I went from being from rural Oklahoma Baptist, and within 2 years was an engaged anti-racist, pro-civil rights, learning about national liberation movements. I met Palestinians at Oklahoma University who told me about, you know, 10 years before how they were kicked out of their houses. And so I started learning about the world, and that's why I think these kids, they're already very well-educated, you know, just fundamentals. They know how to read and write, and they're eloquent. That's what good schools can do, and they should all be like that, should all be like Parkland. But they're gifted children. They are privileged, and I think, for one thing, what I saw at that Washington March is how they understand their privilege and how they made sure Black Lives Matter and other spokespeople were there, inclusive, you know, because they're learning fast. So that's what I have a lot of faith in and how it's ignited. You know, we had big walkouts here on April 20th, and not just to go to Golden Gate Park. It was also 420, you know, but that was when they chose to walk out, you know, walk out from the schools. And so all the schools in the Bay Area, all over the country, and that was led by the Parkland students. But I don't think you're going to get much gun legislation out of it. It's a hot potato because of this grassroots base of the NRA. The NRA is what they do is collect data about everything, down to the sheriff, you know, tiny county or town sheriff election. And then they have members there. They have chapters in every country. These are unpaid gun enthusiasts. This is their main thing in life. We don't have anything like that in our movements. You know, anything like that, an organization that will give us data and everything, and then we do the grassroots work on the ground and get that person unelected or get them elected. And that's how you've gotten the Congress you have now. And the Tea Party was a part of that.
You know, there's a remarkable statistic. I can't remember whether it was in your book or another book I read about the number of those 30% of Americans who are gun owners. For half of them, answer yes to the question, is gun ownership central to your identity? Half of them answer yes to that. And that makes an incredibly powerful political base, because that means, yeah. So what can we find on our side that would be an equivalent thing with which to turn people out for elections?
I don't think getting armed is the, you know, more guns is the question, or the answer, like the NRA, you know, arm the teachers, arm everyone.
I thought the best comment on that, when Trump said arm the teachers, remember the next week some teacher accidentally set off a gun in the classroom, and Andy Borowitz, the New Yorker's wonderful online humorist, suggested the solution is to put a second armed teacher in each classroom to shoot down the first armed teacher in case anything goes wrong. So
it's insane, you know. And what kind of people will then go into teaching as people who are gun nuts, you know, will say, well, here's where I could really, you know, I have to be a cop, you know, and do all that work and deal with dangerous people. The gun legislation is a, you know, that's why I think the conversation should change to looking, you know, really the Second Amendment, challenging it as a white supremacist thing. And if you get into it, really the whole Constitution was a white republic, establishing a white republic. So citizenship, there's still the, you know, the hatred for Mexicans in particular, but immigrants in the past too, Chinese exclusion, of course now Muslims. There's a part of this white nationalism is that other people can come from other places, but they're guests. They're forever guests. Until, you know, these books of how Jewish people became white, how Irish became white. It should be how they became Americanized into this white republic. And a requirement for that is, of course, to be racist and take up the same kind of prejudices.
You know, we've got microphones on each side of the room here, and I think it's time now to open it up for questions from the floor. If any of you have things you'd like to ask Roxanne, please come up to the mic here or over on that side and do so. Do you have a question, or you're adjusting the mic? Okay.
Should just talk. Hello, my name is Oliver Schultz. I've had this argument of gun control versus guns for everybody at my school with some of my friends often. And the main argument that they have that seems to come up again and again is if we take away guns, then only criminals will have guns. What is your response to that?
That it's a white supremacist statement that only African Americans will have guns. See, that's the fear. The fear of that's why we have to bring up things like, you know, positive things like reparations and spread that because we become, you know, kind of defensive instead of countering that with let's have reparations for slavery. Let's have restitution of native lands and real self-determination. Let's have an open border with Mexico because the United States invaded, occupied for 2 years, and took half of Mexico, where we are right now. And that should be an open border. And they should have special rights because of that. We should be making these arguments and countering it and increasing our numbers so that we have a real solid vision of the future to offer that's better than everyone having guns and shooting each other. But we're not really doing that. And I think it's because we're afraid that we kind of buy that, you know, this. Remember, they're just 30%, and we're 70%. But we're not organized, and they are. I mean, we're not woke in that sense of really understanding what we're dealing with. And they're a formidable enemy. And there are many parallels, I think, with Nazi Germany, both South Africa, the Afrikaners taking over.
Hi. Have you heard of an organization called Every Town for Gun Safety or Moms Demand Action? Every Town for Gun Safety, also Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. Do you have any comment about the organization that now has a few more supporters than the NRA at last count.
Well, I'm pretty sure it even has probably some NRA members, you know, or people who are armed, because it's a kind of tricky, because this is the rhetoric of the NRA is gun safety. You know, they offer classes free to schools. Right here, we could say, okay, now we want to organize a class, call up the NRA. They'll bring everything. They'll get the space free if they don't have the space available locally. And they will train you then in how to be addicted to guns under the guise of gun safety. So that is their mantra. So I don't think it's a very good name for, or a very good strategy to talk about gun safety. What we need to talk about is gun regulation, if we're going to talk about anything, because they're all for gun safety, and it's linked to that other question about the criminals will have the guns. You know, that we want orderly, legal guns, and everyone should have them. So I think that, you know, that's part of its popularity, but it's also an entrapment. Is that exactly that kind of strategy?
If I may, Moms Demand Action has chapters in every state, and has had a lot of success in our relatively short life of 5 years, which was founded after the Sandy Hook shootings. And although you may quibble with the name, the goals of the organization are indeed to increase regulation of guns, to keep guns out of the hands of people who are already supposed to be prohibited from having them, and also domestic abusers, to promote safety. Since we do have 300 million guns out there, even if we are able to get excellent regulations that I think most people in this room would support, there's still going to be a lot of firearms out there, and we promote safe storage of firearms. And it turns out most gun owners in this country, when they're polled, actually support all our policy goals like universal background checks and limits on who can have guns.
We're 70%, so we need to organize, but if we don't, what I'm saying is, if we don't understand what the guns are for, we're not going to be able to get rid of them, because they are for maintaining a white republic, restoring and maintaining it. And if we just deal with the symptoms, first of all, only the people who are already convinced, there's no one in that 30% of hardcore gun owners that, gun enthusiasts that are going to change their minds. And they're the ones that are dangerous. So we have to go deeper than that. In every poll that's taken in the United States, the numbers are huge in favor of gun control. 70, 80%. All kinds of polls. Gallup, Pew, university studies. So it's not the problem to get the goodwill, you know, the opinion. The problem is, why is there such a deep gun enthusiasm on the part of the people who do hold guns? And that's what we're not dealing with.
But it's not that enthusiasm on the part of all the people who own guns, because the number of people who are active dues-paying NRA members is a fairly small percentage of the actual gun owners in the country. I'm interested in your group. You have some gun owners who are supportive of
this? Absolutely.
Yeah. And have you had some successes on the state level and legislation getting?
In many, many states. We've stopped bad bills. We've passed some good bills. You're absolutely right. Things are not going to change if people have an opinion but don't do anything about it. So going to the polls with as much passion about preventing gun violence as the NRA has in promoting guns everywhere is going to make a difference. I think that's where the young people come in. They've described themselves as a ticking time bomb of voters because they're tired of being afraid to go to school. And I would just suggest everyone here, it's easy to be pessimistic. I've worked on the gun issue for over 20 years. I was working full-time in gun policy when Columbine happened, which was 19 years ago on April 20th. And we thought that that was it. That was the turning point, and we were going to finally change the laws, and we were wrong. And so I am very guardedly optimistic now. But hearing those young people and seeing the numbers, they mobilized 300 high school students to go up to Sacramento a week ago to walk the halls and lobby for gun legislation. And that's happening all over the country.
Well, I think that, I think that's good. But, and we could, probably should go on to other questions after this, but I want to make a point about gun owners. The NRA has 5 million gun members, dues-paying members. Most of them are, they like to get the perks, you know, and some businesses have actually taken away the perks. But they also get discounts on ammunition. They get discounts on guns. And they're inactive. They're members, like I'm a member of the California Automobile Association, which is a nonprofit. They send me these papers once a year of who to vote for, and I throw it in the trash. I am not an active member. It's a benign organization. But the NRA is not. But the hardcore of NRA, one thing I think we should do, and I hope you will do in your work, is to talk people into leaving the NRA if they don't agree with being in a white net. They say, oh, well, I'm a gun owner. I'm a member of the NRA, and I'm not like that. Well, they should get out. They're in a white nationalist organization, and they should get out. Every self, anyone that comes to you and they have a gun, if they're an NRA member, they should leave the NRA. So I think if you inserted that into it, you would be doing something very productive.
Yeah, please, please comment, and then we'll get to your question over here.
One of the things you will find on the Every Town for Gun Safety website, if you check it out, is a link that will help you follow the money. And you can enter your zip code and you can find out exactly how much money your congressional and local representatives have accepted from the NRA. And there's a draft letter for there for you to send to them to say, if you continue to take their money, you're not going to get my vote. And that's also a very important issue.
That wasn't my point, though. In fact, the NRA spends very little money on lobbying. They have a grassroots devoted constituency, and they do not give very much money. I heard one, you know, they were castigating someone in Florida that took $5,000 from the NRA to get him unelected. That's not even a first-class plane ticket, you know? They give gifts to their friends. They have $300 million a year is their budget. They spend 10% of it on lobbying. It's not about money. Everything, I know it's a capitalist country, but everything in this country is not about money. It's about ideology. You know, so I think unless we get that through our heads and don't keep saying, you know, that the get your legislators out. No, get the NRA members. Talk them out of the NRA. Make them an enemy of the NRA while they're members if they want to stay in and be clandestine. But I recommend you do one thing. Go home. Go to the NRA website and watch their videos. Watch all their videos. That's the NRA. That's the NRA, and that's what their appeal is, not money.
Question over here.
Hi, I want to change the angle a little bit to give your neck a break. And I also want to thank you for your work and thank you for the talk today. It's been very good. My question, or my comment, I'm not sure which, really has to do more with the fact that we talk about the NRA, but we don't talk about weapons manufacturers who owe no liability whatsoever in this process. And the tobacco industry was taken down. I wonder if you'd comment a little bit about that.
Yeah, about
you know, the gun industry, it's an interesting genealogy. It was the first important corporate industry in the United States, other than agribusiness, but industrial corporate. And I know there's this book, Gunning of America, that tries to make you think there was no gun industry. I mean, there was no gun industry until the Civil War, and then it, you know, kind of took over and advertised guns and got everyone to buy them. But actually, as I said, you know, these guns in Virginia and in Massachusetts in 1637, they're required to have two weapons in the house, 20 pounds of powder, and 100 bullets. And if they can't afford it, the colonial government will pay for it. So the gun industry at first was like carpentry, anything else, a craft of making guns. But they made a lot of guns, and there were a lot of gunsmiths. They were among the most numerous of the craftsmen in the colonies. And the actual gun industry didn't just take off during the Civil War. It took off in the Indian Wars, wars against the Indians after independence. And very quickly, the gun industry developed. By 1820, was very developed. And of course, it increased tremendously during the Civil War. It armed everyone, practically, with weapons in a Civil War. And they killed, you know, like 500 million people. So it's the gun industry is pernicious, and it also, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg with the firearms in the United States and how much money they make off of that. The United States export is the main export of both small firearms and up to, you know, all kinds of war materials in the world. No one comes near it. And the gun industry in the United States, I would say if the firearms industry just stopped, let's say a mandate was made and they say no more sale of guns in the United States, like they did in Australia, it wouldn't even hurt their bottom line compared to their exports. So we have to connect those things. Not that that scenario would even happen, and I have a thing why it happened in Australia and could not happen here. they don't have the Second Amendment, for one thing. It's important that no one else in the world has a Second Amendment. You know, it's a unique thing to the United States. So I keep getting back to it. That is what we should be focusing on.
But I think the question was, is there a possibility of making the gun manufacturers financially responsible for the damage they've done in the way that was done with tobacco, where there were these large...
They were until the Republican Congress reversed it a few years ago and made them immune in 2003, made them immune to libel suits.
Were there large settlements paid out before then?
There were some. But not that many. So I think it was after Columbine. You know, that was the most spectacular of the, and it was the school shooting. And many more. You know, the first ones were workplace shootings. The postal system, as it began to privatize and close down, disgruntled workers were, you know, were the main ones. And then, you know, the disgruntled farmers and then the school shootings, and all kinds of venues they started. But Columbine wasn't the first school mass shooting at all, but it was a huge number and you know, spectacular. So it was after that that they got through Congress, you know, that Republican Congress, the immunity. They actually have immunity. So the Democrats have had... resolutions for years that, you know, the Republican, they didn't bring it up during when the Democratic Party had the Congress. They didn't bring that resolution up of to reverse that, you know. And it could go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would probably find it constitutional. You know, that's the problem we have, too.
Okay, I think we have another question over here.
Oh, I am certainly not a gun owner, and I'm in favor of gun control, and But I want to point out that the 70% of non-gun owners are not necessarily all against gun enthusiasm. And I'll just give you a couple examples of that. I have a patient who I saw last week in my office. I've seen him for many years. He's in his 80s. He's in a wheelchair. And he belongs to a gun club and loves to shoot every week. And he was so thrilled last week to tell me how he shot some bullseyes despite his macular degeneration. And so that really, that hobby really keeps him going. And the other example is I have a son who's an officer in the military, and he very much is enthused about weapons and would like to own an AR-15 someday. Not because he's interested in, promulgating America's history of, recent history of wars around the world, or because he's, you know, some sort of white supremacist, but just because he's enthused about it. And I think it's important for people who are interested in gun control to understand that there are a lot of people who aren't gun owners and want to control, want to have better laws, which I certainly do. But they may not necessarily be against those that enjoy enthusiasm for guns and the hobby of guns. I just want to make that comment.
Well, it's a good point. And, of course, when the NRA started, it started as a target practice, recreational and target practice. That's what it kind of remained. And that's when target practice became an Olympic sport in 1876. So a part of this, target shooting. But, you don't need even a gun with lead in it for target shooting. That's a completely different thing. It's like, basketball. You don't need lead in the basketball. You're target shooting. You need to be aiming correctly. So that's a completely different thing. And the number of professional or enthusiast target practitioners with non-lead weapons are minuscule in the United States compared to the rest of the world, So I don't buy that, the target practice thing. I think it's gun addiction. The other thing is that the Second Amendment, that they are, in fact, if people become aware, in fact, that their appetite for guns and the gun culture they then become a part of is grounded in white supremacy. It doesn't mean they're white supremacists, but they're supporting it. I mean, they're collaborating with it. That's what I mean about raising consciousness, say, with your son. Or your patient, say, the sources of that, what that's about. Have you thought of that? Maybe have a pamphlet or something that spells this stuff out. A lot of people would say, be repulsed by it and say, no, okay, I'll choose not to get a gun. But it is a fact that after Sandy Hook, where those children were killed, they did a Gallup did a poll of what the general public thought about the Second Amendment. Did they think it was the right of the individual to bear arms? How many people said it was? 75%. So you're right. It's not just the 30%. There is this sense that there's something positive about gun culture, and there's really not. It really isn't.
We got time for one more question, so
I'll make mine quick. Something that troubles me, I want to go back to this issue of the Second Amendment. Something that troubles me every time I actually talk about it or think about it, gun control, is how much. What's the possibility of going after the Second Amendment, it becoming a slippery slope that the rest of the Bill of Rights can get eroded as well. Does that make sense?
The Bill of Rights.
Okay, so the Bill of Rights, you know, is like this sacred document, and the bill, and we are unique in have that we're the only country that has a Second Amendment. But if we start eroding the Second Amendment, does that then cause a slippery slope for the rest of them? And
well, it's already been greatly eroded by the use of the 14th Amendment by the corporations to be individuals. That was for African Americans to become citizens. And that's what was used to the Supreme Court to make corporations into individuals with the same rights as you and me, but they don't have to go to jail or be executed when they commit crimes or even be charged. So it's already been eroded, you know. And I think that taking the, you know, bringing up the Second Amendment, it does lead to questioning the whole Constitution. For instance, the Electoral College is a white supremacist, you know, with gerrymandering, it is a way of maintaining white power. And it's been very successful. There's white power. There's no doubt about it. I mean, with this administration, you can no longer say, oh, well, there is that HUD guy, but he's the one that did the regulation on the rent being taken away. So we have to face up with, you know, we've come back to the beginnings. And we really have, if we don't grasp this, we're not going to get anywhere. We're going to end up, you know, destroying the world as we destroy ourselves.
Well, I hate to make that the note we end on, but we are out of time. We're going to have to stop. I want to thank you for coming and thank Roxanne for being here. And remind you that she'll be signing books in the atrium right outside. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.